So I'm going to talk about ionic channels and one specialized property of ionic channels that I think we can actually calculate and which we can in fact build. Ionic channels turn out to be a great deal more important than those of us who have worried about them a long time. I started worrying about them, believe it or not, in either September or October of 59. I didn't work on them for a while, but I certainly worried about them. It turns out that they are the main controllers of biological function in much the same sense that transistors are the main controllers of everything that goes on in our computers, including the screen. You can't do an awful lot about engineering a computer without knowing an awful lot about transistors, but the really interesting things in a computer are how they're organized and what they do, and that is true to a large extent for channels too. They are the basic controllers, but how they're organized together is very important. Anybody old enough will, I hope, enjoy the exact pun between a valve, vacuum tube, PNP transistor, and FET transistor, which actually carries through to the mathematics. Now, it's very important for us to understand right from the beginning, a valve is an English name for a vacuum tube. Chemically specific properties, as we all know, are one of the hallmarks of life. It's very important for us to understand that when we write equations, chemically specific properties are exactly the things which do not follow ideal properties that are defined by the what's called the excess chemical potential. So if a theory assumes something is ideal in ionic solutions, it cannot deal with chemical specificity in a physical way. So we're going to be talking about ions in water and ions in channels. And again, it's quite important, I find, in talking to a younger biologist to emphasize that life occurs in salt water and that calculations and analyses of proteins and so on in distilled water are likely to be as successful as experiments in which proteins are put in distilled water. This doesn't usually work. The other point that is often not understood is that some of the most important and simplest properties of ionic solutions have no theory of any kind that a physicist would recognize as a theory to this day. The density of mixtures of salts, sodium and calcium, just the density, how high a column of water gets in a separatory funnel or something like that, or a burette when you pour in salt, is very complicated as a function of concentration. And in fact, chemical engineers use equations of state with several hundred variables to describe these things when they want to get them right so a boiler doesn't explode. There is no mathematics that by itself, with a few parameters that are either effective or well known, that will compute properties of mixtures. And that's because of the interactions and the very strong correlations in ionic solutions. You don't buy sodium, you buy sodium chloride. I believe, although it may not be generally agreed, that actually a new kind of mathematics is needed for that. And just to emphasize that, I should also point out that Brownian motion theory, which many people would say is a well-developed physical model of ionic solutions, is always done for uncharged molecules. Even though there are no Q's or Poisson equation or Coulomb equation, and that's a bit of a problem both from a historical and logical point of view because Brown was describing colloids that were highly charged. So ion channels are a very good test case for trying to do physics realistically in biology, and what I'm going to try to do here is to take a part of the properties of ion channels, which is pretty significant, and thanks to David, we know very significant in biology, namely calcium binding. And I'm going to try to do physics that all of you who have, are professional physicists should recognize. It might be wrong, but it's specific, it's equations, there are no metaphors, there are no arrows. Everything can be computed by different methods and getting the same answer. So this is possible for ion channels because the physics that is involved in ion channels is relatively simple. It all occurs at biological temperature. It's electrodiffusion with maybe a little bit of convection, possibly a little bit of heat flow. But these things are incredibly simpler physics than stuff that physicists compute with arbitrary accuracy every day. So in case you don't know about that, the airplane that you came in was designed by solving equations, literally solving equations, not simulations, and those equations can be solved more accurately than you can do wind tunnel experiments, and as accurately as measurements can be on the, done on the plane. But people actually don't make measurements on the plane because it's so hard. Sorry, what? I've just been with a whole meeting of hydrodynamics people make their living computing airplane wings.
Yeah, no, I know those people. Anyway, we talk about that later.
They do very well. People computing, Boeing people computing an airplane wing. Well, no, this is really very important. The flow of air over an airplane wing and transonic wing is fantastically complicated. It's so complicated that nobody can tell what's going to happen if they move one of those little tabs 2 or 3 inches along the wing. Those can be calculated accurately. Water waves in the ocean, including the foam, have been calculated by Philip Rosenau and checked against experiment.
We could have did the...
Okay.
There's a lot of things in the sentences that you just made. I just wanted to make it clear that they were somewhat controversial.
Yeah, but, okay. No, but this is extremely important. These, in this device, there are a trillion transistors. They don't fail. If they fail, it stops. That's calculated by solving what we call the PNP equations. There are no errors. When a sound is calculated, there are essentially no errors. The masks that are used for transistors, which solve Helmholtz equation, are way below the wavelength of light, have essentially no errors. Biologists, you know much better, but many biologists, in my experience, simply don't understand that there are extremely complicated things that can be calculated with great accuracy.
Yeah, I mean, look, I make a living on this, but I just wanted to repeat that that what you just said is somewhat controversial, but we could argue about that later. Keep going. No,
okay.
I don't want to go off of Ion Channel.
Okay, Ion Channel.
We should schedule another meeting in which we should. I think this would be good. We could get here and we could have a meeting about.
Yeah, well, especially because some of the mathematics, which I'm not talking about today, is in fact straight from fluid dynamics.
Right.
Anyway, we'll move along. Ion channels, once they are open, have a single structure on the biological timescale, meaning if you take time slices, I think there are some chairs over there, it's not worth, okay. If you take time slices of 5 microseconds and define that as a structure, classical channels have a single structure, meaning that the current through them does not change and has no internal correlations, whether it's 10 microseconds long or 10 seconds long. This is very, very important because nobody knows how to compute structural changes in proteins, but electric diffusion might be much easier. A simple theory is possible. In my opinion, there is an existence theorem, if I could use the math language, because channels are devices. They actually satisfy the engineering definition of devices. They have inputs, outputs, and power supplies. And like all other devices, they can only work because they are reasonably robust transfer functions. This is fancy language for saying if you have an amplifier, you can describe it by one number to begin with, its gain. And the last thing in the world you want to know about that amplifier is its equivalent circuit, and no engineer would ever think of wanting to know what all its atoms do. Okay? And that is a perfectly well-defined quantity, and in my opinion, there are equivalent descriptions possible for channels. And channels are biologically very important. Now, I think it's important to go through this, even though it's boring to many of you, because in my experience, a lot of people have lost this information, which was well known a long time ago. Ion channels coordinate contraction in the heart. The heart is an example of dreadful design. Because it controls the human heart and the mammalian heart, because its control system is its contractile system. Any failure in channels in the heart means that you go into ventricular fibrillation, you don't pump blood. Ion channels coordinate contraction in skeletal muscle. That's important even in an aging obese male like myself, because about half of my body mass is a skeletal muscle, and I don't breathe well if it doesn't work. Ion channels control all electrical activity in cells. They produce signals of the nervous system, which are obviously of great importance, etc. Ion channels are directly involved in thousands of diseases. If you type channelopathy or channel disease into Google, you will find thousands of hits of genetically known channel diseases, and there are major diseases like cystic fibrosis, which are channel diseases. Fortunately, ion channels are proteins whose genes can be manipulated by molecular genetics. That means that we are able to control the what I call permanent charge distribution in a channel more accurately than physical scientists can control charge distribution in almost any non-crystalline material. Now, those of you from the physical sciences may need to have a little translation table. What a chemist and molecular biologist calls acid, you call negative, and what a chemist calls basic, you call positive. So the location of negative and positive charge can be controlled remarkably well by site-directed mutagenesis. And the defect in ion channels is that we have structures of very few of them, although increasingly many. So because of this enormous importance, ion channels are studied experimentally, literally, by thousands of molecular biologists every day. We have some handle on this because the AxoPatch amplifier, which I designed about 20 years ago, and estimated would sell 300, Alan Finkel estimated 50, and it's very worthy competitor of a list amplifier, which has about 20% of the market. We have about 80%. We've sold well over 10,000 of these amplifiers, and they're not very useful for anything except recording currents. So it's an estimate of how much work is going on.
Paperweights, Bob.
Yeah. When they don't work, they usually last pretty well, don't they?
Yeah.
Okay, well then that means that they're probably not quite as many, but there are a lot of them. And this is the setup that is used very widely, actually more widely for single channel recording than the patch clamp method. And thanks to Chris Miller, we all know how to do it. And thank you, Chris. It's important in what I'm talking about to understand I'm talking about what happens once a channel is open. And once a channel is open, this current record is flat, independent of duration. It has actually a much narrower distribution than this. I don't know why this fellow drew this one. But I will not be talking about the gating process that does the opening of the channel. And that is quite a separate process. It is modulated very differently. And the role of physics in it is much more indirect. So I've given up a major part of biology, probably 80 or 90% of the function of channels is in gating, in order to be able to do what I hope is real physics on the remaining part.
But if you can explain to us, I mean, or at least to me anyway, why changing four amino acids switches a calcium channel to a sodium channel, I'd be very grateful.
Oh, I can show that to you. The answer,
you're going to talk about it.
And more important with that, I don't want to personify this. We can build one.
Okay,
and it follows the equations, and it's been, no, but you're a physicist, so I want to answer your question. It's been done by Monte Carlo simulation, density functional theory, solvent primitive model, and the MSA. It was started here.
Site-directed mutagenesis.
Oh, no, the experiments did it first. Wait, Chris is, I apologize. We had the target because site-directed mutagenesis told us about it. Mea culpa. Absolutely. But that you'll see the slide quotes the experiments first. But this is very important. It's also been done in four or five different competitive laboratories. This has actually been checked.
No, good.
And the answer to your question now in physics is that it's a balance between excluded volume and electrostatics. And that it turns out that if you put four glutamates in a small space, that balance goes for calcium. And if you put something else in, it isn't. And actually, we don't know better than that. So to make my bow to evolution, which will start with a statement that I actually spent a lot of time reading textbooks of evolution as an undergraduate, but that was so many years ago that it's embarrassing. So if I misuse these words, I hopefully will be criticized if I don't use them the way they were in Romer's book and George Gaylord Simpson and that sort of stuff, which is where I learned the material, and I guess to some extent from Stephen Jay Gould. There's a seat over here. It really is not worth standing for what I have to say. Yeah, okay. So selectivity is an adaptation necessary for channels to function. These are the channel types that we've worked on. The best evidence for the model I'm talking about is, in fact, from the ryanodine receptor. And judging from the way these talks go, I will not be able to give that evidence, but it's all in the computer, where hundreds of current voltage curves have been fit with models with four or five parameters that don't change. You will read a lot about work on K-channel selectivity, but most of the work in K-channel selectivity, all of the work at Benoit and Susan Rempe, has much more atomic detail than we have, and therefore is very much to be praised. It includes water in a reasonable way that we're not able to do. But it is all done either at an indefinite ionic concentration or at one ionic concentration, and without mixtures of ions of definite activity. Now, those of you who are experimentalists should understand something very clearly. Galileo established a long time ago that experiments are true and not theory. If a theory doesn't include a variable that you know is crucial experimentally, it's likely to leave out something important. And that's particularly true if it leaves out a variable which is a control variable. And as we heard from David, calcium is a control variable. And I am unaware of any molecular dynamics simulation that gets the activity ratio of calcium or sodium within 20 kT. We just have published a paper surveying all the available ones, and they are typically 40 kT off. I like to use units of kT. 40 kT off means that one trajectory will be right in the history of the universe. So this word of specificity is important not just because David and I say so. Aaron Klug very nicely wrote had a quotation in a Nature paper. I think he somewhat overdid it, but that's what he actually said. One word that matters in biology is specificity. He went on to say it can't be calculated, so we'll see what we can do with that. And my goal is to understand selectivity in a very concrete experimental way, by fitting large amounts of data and actually making a calcium channel. I'm entirely impatient with poetic discussions of physical functions. Those have not been used in physics since essentially ever, and engineers do not build anything by words. And so, again, for physical scientists, it's very important that you understand when you read a paper in IEEE something or other, and somebody says so-and-so does so-and-so, in words. That means if you write him, he can give you an objective computer program or a function that will do what he said. When a biologist describes how a molecule moves or describes a theory with arrows, there very rarely is an objective piece of code that will compute anything. So the way I deal with this is very straightforwardly. I believe in taking theories and simulations and computing the actual curves that experimental people report, even if I don't think it's the right.
What's the definition of the word make on the slide?
We have taken a porin that has absolutely nothing to do with an L-type calcium channel and engineered it in a series of four papers according to the precepts of this theory and got about three quarters of the way to a calcium channel. And the one
that you're able to predict, but is if I give you a sequence in a sodium channel, are you able to tell what I can do to make it detect?
No, but if you give me a structure that has a well-defined pore, I know what site, what mutations to make.
So if we give you the structure, then you can tell us what we're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And is there are no structures for sodium and calcium channels?
There isn't a problem. We have taken, No,
I'm just trying to understand.
No, there isn't a problem.
I'm trying to figure out what can and can't.
Okay, well, so let me answer your question. You gotta let me talk for a second. The answer is that we took a porin, working with experimental people who are totally skeptical of any theory. We're very good friends. Might have been Chris, wasn't, and challenged me. Okay, Bob, if this silly math is working, then if we've put four glutamates in this place in our porin, we ought to get a calcium channel. I said, yes, they did that. It was hard. we got about half the way to a calcium channel. Then we looked at, we didn't have a structure. Tillman Shermer has actually done structures since then, but that's unpublished. But it was clear from just building models that we had not made the pore small enough. So then we put in glutathione derivatives, make the pore much smaller, and we got 3/4 of the way to a calcium channel, which is about what the theory says we should have for that volume.
So if I could answer your question another way, you can take a sodium channel and turn it 2 to 3 mutations, substitutions into a calcium channel.
Yeah.
For example.
That was
take a known sodium selective and turn it into calcium.
Experimentally, but I mean,
that's what I'm
saying. And we do that by theory too.
It's known to an extent that if I give you a sequence, that you can tell me what kind of channel.
No. If you give us a sequence, nobody can tell you what the structure is.
But even if there's a lot of homology, right? So there's these six.
You can guess.
You can guess, but you're not going to guess.
For example. Really well. When we did match track in bacteria, we looked at it, we thought it was a calcium channel. And when we measured it, it turned out to be a sodium channel.
But I would go so far as to say that I'm going to give you a working hypothesis, okay, which has not been checked against NatchBack and absolutely has to, so I want to plead guilty immediately. A working hypothesis as to what the important physics is that can be directly checked even without a structure. Doesn't mean it's right, but it's concrete and specific.
There are two different issues here which are related, right? One is, you know, if you want to do level, I mean, if you want to plug in trees, then you would like, and I think it would be nice to be able to identify the sequence if it worked out generally. But then there's, of course, if you knew the structure, do you understand the physics well enough to basically do it? And you're, as I understand, talking about the latter.
No, I'm going to argue that two things are intermingled. This is the whole point of my talk.
No,
much more than, oh what? I'm going to argue in my model, my model is so minimal that the structure is actually computed in my model, okay? Which you have every right to think is crazy. But just so everybody understands, in my model, the protein is represented as a cylinder with loose carboxylates. The carboxylates are at their free energy minimum. And one of the most important potential lessons of our work is that the sensitivity to location of the carboxylates is so enormous that they have to be in their free energy minimum by calculation, way beyond anything that could be resolved in X-ray. Now, that's a working hypothesis. That is the end of my talk. Okay. Now, I want to argue here that the essence of doing this kind of work is dealing with intelligent reduced models. These models have inputs, outputs, and power supplies. They are, these reduced models are exactly the kind of thing engineers almost universally use to describe devices. They are not unique. If you want to describe an amplifier, you have to say whether you are interested in the distortion or the speed. But even if you want to do a very realistic description of an amplifier, an audio amplifier, you really only need a few parameters to do that. And it's not terribly important whether that amplifier is made of bipolar transistors or field effect transistors or vacuum tubes. What is important is the transfer function. And I would argue that the reduced models themselves are the adaptation created by evolution. The reduced model, the physics of the reduced model, and that's why I picked on what you said, because it's not just the structure, it's the entire physics of the system to create the biological function. And I would argue, according to what I was taught and dimly remember, that the reduced model that I'm talking about actually satisfies the definition of the phenotype that I was taught many, many years ago. Now, the reason that this is not empty philosophizing is that engineers know an enormous amount about the question of how do you measure what a reduced model is, and how well to determine it, and how does it predict future behavior and other behavior. And that's called the theory of inverse problems and reverse engineering. And that's something that, in my experience, very few scientists know much about. I didn't know anything about until I actually worked with some of these people. But I think it's extremely important because there are objective ways to deal with the issues in inverse problems. I would also argue that all of these things, evolutionary adaptation, underlying physics, device equation, and reverse engineering, are what Alan Hodgkin and Bernard Katz used to call understanding physiology. That word physiology is about 2,000 years older than the word engineering, and that the goal of physiology has been exactly this since Aristotle invented the word. So we're going to try to fit large amounts of data, enough of this vagueness. And because I talk a great deal, I want to show you the actual result. This is the porin that we started with, which has no homology. It's a totally different structural plan from channels in L-type calcium channels. And it's essentially non-selective. I forgot exactly what solution we used here.
These are measurements.
I'm sorry. These are measurements of current voltage relations from single channels that Johnny Tang, Hank Miedema, and I took, okay, and of mutants. And when you follow the prescriptions that we're going to talk about, which is basically as simple as putting four glutamates in a very small space, and you put in glutathione to make the space smaller, you get a highly calcium-selective channel. And because Hank, being a good friend, was extremely skeptical, he actually did the mutation two different ways.
Selected for calcium over...
Calcium over chloride, of course, chloride. Calcium...
I mean, is this a pure calcium chloride gradient?
There's some sodium. There's some competing cation. But the way it fails is that it's not as selective over potassium at all as the real one. But, okay?
Yeah.
But I want to be real careful with this. I'll show you later a curve of volume. We only have two parameters in the model, volume and dielectric constant. If the volume is the size that we have here from a model, it should not be selective for calcium over sodium very much. That is the theory, with all the parameters pinned down, says that we just aren't small enough. And to your question, we don't know how to make the space smaller. Tillman actually has a mutant that may make the space smaller. He's structuring right now. But we don't know. So the question is, how do we make a physical model of ion channels? And ion channels, again, and I'm sorry to argue with my very kind and generous host, who I forgot to thank for inviting me to Paradise. I love coming here. And by the way, this work was started in this room at the ITP by Wolfgang Nonner and myself at a meeting in 98. The question is, where do we start? And we might start in many different places. But I want to reiterate to you that the physics we're going to be dealing with is extraordinarily simpler than the things we were arguing about. How well physical scientists do on these other things, maybe we can argue. But the physics involved in phenomena that are in transistors and so on are fantastically more complicated than the issue of just spheres going through holes, which is what I'm trying to build here. I didn't say more complicated than real channels. That's the target. But I'm trying to test the hypothesis that spheres going through holes of fixed structure can explain this. And the physics there is relatively simple. And I should just make a comment that many of the traditional approaches to these things do not work and don't lead to quantitative science, in my view. So the crucial step in this sort of thing is to guess intelligently what kind of reduced model you would use. In my view, science is all guess and check, the guess being done recklessly with great intuition and the methods of inverse problems sort of guiding you, and the checking being done as carefully as one possibly can. So as a biologist, you have a tremendous advantage, especially if you've been raised in the English tradition of physiology, of using the biology to help guess the adaptation, which in my language is to guess the reduced model. You look for what's strange. So if you have a hunk of tissue that's reflecting light, you study it as a lens. If you have a ball socket joint in a bone, you look up the theory of bone socket joints. You don't write general mechanical equations. So if we look at channels and indeed in active sites, the most striking physical property of them, in my view, is their enormous charge density. So I want to be sure everybody understands this, because as far as I know, and Chris may know otherwise, but I'm unaware of this fact being pointed out clearly in biochemistry books. If you take the number of acid or base residues within a Debye length of an active site, you know that there will be the equal number of counterions nearby. And in fact, in many proteins and channels, these can actually be resolved in X-ray. If you take that number and divide by the volume, which is what Wolfgang and I first did here, having stupidly not done this for 10 years, you get number densities of the order of 20 molar. These are charge densities that are hundreds or thousands of times higher than Intel can create in a transistor. Intel would give you many billions of dollars, I'm really not kidding, if you went up there and you said to them, here's how to make 20 molar charge, because the transistor would be fantastically faster. So this is an extremely unusual system to have this enormous charge density, especially when you remember that these charges are spheres nearly filling the space with little room for water. So what we're going to try to do is to...
Are you making this estimate that the charge is additive, that the charge on one side is...
I'm not adding anything. I'm doing accounting.
No, but I guess I just want to understand how you're doing accounting. So you're
You're a physicist. We solve Poisson.
No, but...
That's how we do the adding. We write boundary conditions. I'm sorry, you're a physicist. When we actually do the adding, we compute the electric forces. When we do the adding, the correct way to do it is to compute the electric field, the electric forces. We do that by either solving Poisson equation with boundary conditions or Coulomb's law with all charges. So we never add them. This is just a verbal discussion for people here.
You're saying, by talking about solving Poisson, I'm not a physicist, so you're just talking about the mobile ions there, right? That is
no, whatever's in the model.
No, but I mean, you have fixed charges in your model.
And sometimes...
Right? Yeah, and those are fixed.
There are about 75... Wait a second, let me answer your question. There are 75 papers on this because we have done many, many different variations. Whatever the model has specified for charge, we solve self-consistently by Coulomb or Poisson. This is a very important point for the audience.
I'll look at that picture. Yeah. I see positive charges and negative charges. Those are fixed charges come from the protein.
Right.
So those are inputs to your...
Depends on which paper.
Well
in some
papers... writing a paper on this picture.
No, I mean, I'm not going to get into a debate with you. This is
specific answer.
How can that be a specific answer when there are 20 papers doing different variations on it?
You're not being fair. I'm sorry. Go back, because you're back to your...
Here is the model that I will be showing today. The papers I'm based on counts the carboxylates as spheres and computes the electric charge from them.
Charged spheres.
Negatively charged spheres.
Yeah. Each ball gives you
half charge. No, minus one half, because the oxygens on a carboxylate we treat as equivalent.
Those are specific oxygens there. Okay, minus one half. Okay. That's all. Okay. I think that's all.
That's what
we're asking. Very simple.
Yeah, but the point I want to make, and the reason I'm making it, is because this is what I'm about to say is rarely true in biological calculations. Every model we ever calculate, the electric field is computed from all the charges present, and the system is self-consistent. Whatever we specify as the important charges in the system, we actually calculate. Yeah, but the reason why it's not just fine is because there is not a single paper on K-channel selectivity for which that's true.
So bioinformatics, so you said that an active site can be recognized by a very high charge density.
Usually associated with.
Okay. So for example, of course, to get the charge density, we need the structure. So let's take a protein with a known structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you tell us what, so we would just count, charged residues,
mm-hmm.
Volume of structure.
Yeah.
And
I'm not in bioinformatics. I haven't done that. That should be done.
So then the question is, so we will get some distribution
absolutely.
Of densities.
And that's exactly what should be done.
Okay, and so what's going to happen? These active buckets will come out as 3 sigma outliers on the 5 sigma density.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly what should be done. Even easier is to search the database for all of the proteins in which the counterions have been resolved. Okay? And then simply divide by the volume that those ions are in. For example, in the K-channel, the rubidiums come out to be about 20 molar.
Yeah, so for example, speaking of those dipolar ions, they're going to enter into this charge calculation big way, for example.
You can't just search sequences.
You have to have structures, yeah. I'm sorry, structures, I meant...
No, but with HOMOLA, if you are reasonably confident, say with an enzyme active site, that you have 250 HOMOLAs, that are going to be... similar structures. You could, in principle, do that.
It'd be very interesting. It hasn't been done as far as I know. Okay? But from really very old-fashioned stuff in the 1950s and 60s, where people just did all sorts of chemistry, we know that these sites are highly charged. Yeah?
Perhaps you're going to talk about later, but how do you bundle water here?
Water is treated as a dielectric. This is called the implicit model.
That's it, so you have epsilon equals 80 and...
No, we don't have epsilon 80, we have an epsilon. So we're going to make a working hypothesis, which is going to be strikingly different from what most of you are used to. We're going to argue that in a bulk solution of sodium chloride and calcium, it is well known that there is a reduced model that does extremely well, that involves only the diameter and charge of the ion and has nothing to do with hydration or any other things that are usually called chemical. And that's not my work. There are hundreds or even thousands of papers on this in the literature. And in fact, when this model was done correctly, and I'll explain to you the secret in a second, which was, by the way, what the meeting was about in 1998 when we were here. When this model was done correctly, you are able to predict the free energy versus concentration of pure solutions, calcium or sodium, all the way up to saturation within about 1 or 2%. This can be done quantitatively by a whole different group of things using the dielectric constant. And you're within about 10 or 15% if you use some effective fixed constant. But the secret was discovered by Lesser Bloom, who was at that meeting. If you use the dielectric constant of the ionic solution, which is an experimental variable, then these models work remarkably well.
Ionic composition.
And it varies a great deal, by the way. I mean, in these concentrated solutions, there are maxima and minima, and what can't be done are the mixtures. Okay, they're still, well, it can only be done by an enormous phenomenological equation. So we, Wolfgang and I said, well, how will this work in channels? And the question is, how well does it work? And just to give you a little hint, we're going to show that it works pretty well, and that therefore the bottom line, the answer to Michael's question, is that selectivity arises from the crowding of ions, which means calculating two energies accurately, or really three. One is the energy of the fixed charges. By fixed, I'm going to use permanent because they're not geometrically fixed. Okay, they don't vary.
Their magnitude is also not fixed.
No, their magnitude is fixed. Sodium charge. Wait.
Oh, no, you're talking about sodium. We're not talking about the charging of the amino acids.
No.
Different types of charges.
Yeah, but you interrupted me before I said the second type of charge was the dielectric charge. So our model has in two kinds of charge. One is the fixed charge, which is independent of everything in this model, and the second is computed by the divergence of E. Okay, by the Poisson equation. That is by the definition of a linear dielectric. Now we're talking about the model, not the protein. Okay, so we're making, nobody believes, by the way, I'm about to tell you that the model is ridiculous. I just haven't had a chance to do that.
Just one other question about your model. So do you take protonation of the carboxylates into account?
Yes, it's extremely important. And we deal with that in the calcium channel by dealing with that at pH 8, because we simply
eliminate
it experimentally. We actually have a paper showing how to do this in a computationally efficient way, but we've not gone on and checked it all of which should be done. Okay, so we have not done that. Okay, now when I talked about this new mathematics, Chris, it turns out in this new mathematics, one simply has to add into the energy term the term for that, and the mathematics will produce the answer. But it has not been done and checked. So we have to say we simply don't know how well we do with that. And I want to point out that the work I'm going to show you today has all been done by Monte Carlo simulations of spheres. Okay. Now this is an extremely well-established method. One really does know that it produces the full Boltzmann distribution very robustly, but it's not a functionally good way to do this stuff because it is at equilibrium. And we are working, there are two ways to move off equilibrium, neither of which I'll be talking about this morning in any detail. There's a combined density functional theory in PNP, which Dirk Gillespie and I started, and Dirk has exploited in a whole series of papers showing that it works very well. And much better, there's an energy variational method which is derivable. Density functional theory is not derivable. That does much the same thing. And I want to point out that this equilibrium business, from a physicist's point of view, is an extremely important part of the history of physical chemistry. Statistical physics was worked out for uncharged systems. When you put charge in, you have to have boundary conditions, or the system is not well posed. And boundary conditions are very hard to define in a classical statistical ensemble. So there is very serious difficulty. And the joke here is, of course, that Maxwell invented both statistical physics, as Boltzmann was glad to say. Boltzmann did much more with it, and the electric field. And one has to believe if he had lived a few more years, he would have tried to put them together. This energetic variational analysis developed by Chun Liu for charged spheres, actually charged oil droplets in the Navier-Stokes system, is completely worked out. And he and Jung-Kyung and I are now developing that into a field theory of non-ideal ionic solutions. And it's pretty far along. Now, the phenomena that I'm going to try to talk about is the binding phenomena that David was talking about, of a calcium binding protein, or in our case, the L-type calcium channel. And that classic experiment would be to have a background concentration of 100 millimolar sodium chloride, 0.1 molar sodium chloride, and a variable amount of calcium. And you find that when there is no calcium around, the system is filled with sodium, which, by the way, is not obvious because it might collapse, but in fact, it's perfectly viable. When you're up to 10 minus 6 molar, it's about half filled with calcium. And at higher concentrations, it's all filled with calcium. So the question is, can we produce that curve from theory?
Sorry, what's the volume of your
pore? Volume is 330 cubic angstroms in the model. We don't have a structure.
So very few ions will give you this high molarity number.
Yes. Yeah, but now
your volume is typical of something like a porin, right? I mean, that's a number you.
This is a typical volume for any active site, actually. Many active sites are of this sort of size.
What's the number of ions when you say 20 molar?
I'll show you. Now, it's very important when people are wondering about this number of ions to understand the kind of averaging that's involved, because it's not the obvious one. The spaces involved in the protein function are extremely small, and things are discrete, and one can worry very much about how to do the spatial averaging. But the time averaging is tremendously long, because the time scale of atomic motion is of the order of 10 minus 16 seconds. Biology doesn't do very much until about 10 minus 4. So there is huge time averaging, but little spatial averaging. It's obvious that one cannot derive anything over those set of scales, because it's easy to make counterexamples for any simplification. So what we're doing is an engineering approach. We take an extremely simple, even ridiculous model. We guess. You have every right to say it's completely ridiculous, which is, by the way, what its authors thought when they thought of it in this room. Okay? Ridiculous to compute a protein and treat the protein as a small little pillbox and the side chains as just 8 spheres, which is what we did. Those spheres are trapped in this region. They're not allowed to go out. And that's the whole model.
Just out of curiosity, how do you decide the ionic radii of
the... We take them from a textbook. So Marcus's...
So you assume that the ionic radii are not affected by the high pressure.
Exactly.
Which is not obvious.
No, it is obvious for sodium and potassium and calcium. They're known to be very hard. One can do quantum mechanics and put an electric field on them, see how much they're distorted. One can study all that. It's not true for chloride. You're absolutely right. Chloride has a variable diameter, but chloride doesn't enter much here. Okay. But I want to be careful, Michael, in addressing these questions. We are doing what an engineer does. He has a black box. He says, I want to check if it's a gain. I measure it. Nobody is arguing that the gain will be exact. It clearly will not be exact. We are trying to find a reduced description, and then we will add complexity as we need to. Okay? And we believe this is a very, very important distinction in how one goes about these things from the approach of inverse problems, because we think it's obvious that one cannot do the forward problem uniquely over 12 orders of magnitude of time, period, because it's always easy to create a counterexample. So here is the model. It's just 8 half-charged spheres representing the carboxylates. What's very important is that as we change conditions, these carboxylates will be in different positions. There's nothing constraining them except the absolute constraint in the Monte Carlo that they be in this region. If a trial puts them out of this region, we reject the trial. We count it as a chance, but we reject it. Okay? So the carboxylates are in here.
I see. So in reality, these red spheres are actually tethered to the outside.
Tethered in this very peculiar way.
Well, what you're doing, which is interesting, is you're just allowing them to move.
Yes.
And you're going to allow them to move to basically, and then you're going to put them, okay, I think I understand.
Okay.
So move anywhere within the volume.
Mm-hmm.
They're just constrained to stay in the box.
And then you're going to ask something like, where should I put them to basically make the thing?
No.
No.
No. We're going to only do the forward problem. We haven't done the inverse problem for this. We've done the inverse problem for something else, but not
reality,
for this.
In reality, if you were to look at a structure, I guess I just want to understand the relationship of this to a structure.
It would be worthless because the structure is done in an unknown ionic environment.
No. I didn't mean that literally. In reality, if you were to look at a selective ion channel in its correct environment, the red spheres really would be tethered.
Absolutely, and would have some restraining force. They'd have a restraining force, and they would have an energy which is not counted in the model. So the model is absolutely incorrect. It is guess and check. We are guessing that these are the important energies. Then we are, yeah, I understand, but the biologists don't do things this way. You guys do it. We are guessing a specific structure and then computing its energies as carefully as we know how.
But is it important for you that the red balls bounce about there, or if you
yes.
Yes.
Everything changes. We have, this is not published, but my graduate student's thesis is just about finished. And it's incredibly important. Not only do they have to be in the right position, they have to have the right entropy.
And the boundary condition on this cylinder?
Well, that's, again, different in each one. For the Monte Carlo case, this is an equilibrium system, so we use insulating boundary conditions. In the now, just the formal words to everybody, this problem has been done with what's called the MSA, which is an equilibrium theory. The solvent primitive model is equilibrium theory. It's done with PNP-DFT, in which case we do the realistic boundary conditions of an electrochemical cell. It's been done with ANERVA, which is this variational method. That means Dirichlet boundary conditions for concentration and concentration and insulating boundary conditions at right angles. It matters in detail, but they all give the same phenomenon I'm going to show you. It matters a great deal if you want to predict current voltage relation, because you can't do it at equilibrium.
And
this
phenomenon, what are you
choosing? That's actually here for visual effect in this. Okay, it makes a great deal of difference in the non-equilibrium calculations.
And the height of
We choose it arbitrarily. We guessed, and we just have a paper, I'm not sure if it's out yet, showing that the length of the channel doesn't change things very much. To our surprise, by the way, Chris, we were very worried about it. But it doesn't change anything qualitatively at all. The volume is the important variable. And I should say that the business about the mathematics, computing a three-dimensional flow problem is a non-trivial issue. Okay, so the people who have done that, Uwe Hollebach, and deserve a lot of credit. And the DFT-PNP that Dirk did, that there's nobody else in the world doing that in physical chemistry. So it's a real math issue. Now, what I'm talking about today is much simpler because I wanted to be sure to get the chemistry in detail right. And the Monte Carlo is the most robust way to do that. So what we're actually doing is an old-fashioned Donnan equilibrium, which, what was 1895, Chris, or something like that. We are actually just setting equal the electrochemical potential in two regions. And we are computing the electrochemical potential inside the channel from the spheres. We are extremely careful with the dielectric properties. And the dielectric properties are a good example of why younger people, of whom there aren't enough in the audience, should not pay attention to people with gray hair. Computing the dielectric energy of spheres near curved boundaries is a problem that you would have thought the applied mathematicians and physicists would have worked out in 1890, but they haven't, at least in a computationally efficient way. And if you know somebody who has done it, please tell me. But I was just at a math meeting of PDE people in Taiwan, and they agree it hasn't been done in a way with multipoles and boundary elements and high accuracy. And in any case, I thought it was going to be a very hard problem, so we didn't work on it. And I also thought it wouldn't be important, Chris, because the induced charge was roughly a quarter or whatever of the fixed charge. Dirk Gillespie worked on it following a lead from Jean-Pierre Hansen and learned how to do this calculation with a speed up of about 100,000 times and found a terrible numerical error, which I want to be sure to tell everybody about. If you calibrate your calculations for spheres against a flat plane, the calculation looks quite simple. If you give it even a little curvature, you find gross numerical troubles unless you fix it up. So when we put in that dielectric energy, then the entire properties of the system rearranged. Even though the energies were small, this is a nonlinear system. It's self-organizing, and it reorganized itself into something different. My advice, don't calculate it because it's too hard and it won't matter, was dead wrong. The reason this model worked as well as it did, this is for sodium potassium, Chris, to be specific, is because my younger colleagues had the good sense not to listen to the gray-haired old guy and went ahead and did it right. So here's your answer about the ions. The ions have their Pauling diameters in quotes. I think we actually got it from Marcus. All of the Monte Carlo work has been done with Dejo Boda and Douglas Henderson, who have something of the order of 100 papers in physical systems using this code. So that was why we were quite confident that it was calibrated and well used, not because we wrote it. Now, we've rewritten it twice since then, three times since then, and everybody gets the same answer to 16 figures. Well, yesterday someone found a bug in one particular case. Well, yeah. Yeah, it's very important because if you say a calculation of energies in gramicidin or a calculation of energies in K-channels, it is not true that everybody gets the same answers in the same setup. Okay? We get the same answers in the same setup. So the question now is, how does the protein produce this binding? And I just want to point out that this is very much an inverse problem, asking how does the device work? And that what we are looking for in the language of some mathematicians is a slow variable, an intermediate description between all the detailed physics, the justification for which is evolutionary, that evolution may have chosen this as the robust parameter that is important. This is sort of very philosophical stuff for simply saying your heart's not going to work if it doesn't have enough calcium inward current.
I'm really curious how these red spheres.
Oh, okay. Well, let's just go down to that. Okay. So there it is. There are two adjustable parameters. The parameters are the diameter of the channel and the dielectric coefficient. And these are the binding curves for calcium.
So your measurement of selectivity here is equilibrium occupancy.
Yes. Yes, because that is what that's not.
I want to make sure I understand this. This is the equilibrium occupancy
of the box by the two ions.
And so you have a reservoir on both sides of the ion, and then you basically have these big red spheres. And you hold, the red spheres aren't allowed to go out of the box. They have to stay in the box, yeah. The red spheres. And then
the mobile ions go in and out.
But the mobile ions go in and out, and then you simply compute the equilibrium. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Very simple.
Wait one second.
Just one more second. We do this not because we think is the right measurement, but this is what because that's what Almers and McCleskey reported. We think that the right measurement is current voltage curves, which Dirk has published four papers on, and I can show you later.
Well, they're all measurement. I mean, what Almers and McCleskey reported was a measurement on the system. It was a perfectly valid measurement.
You're absolutely right, Chris. I didn't speak carefully enough. The current voltage curve is a far more sensitive determinant.
It's another property.
No, it's much,
much more stringent.
Yes, exactly.
Could you repeat what the two parameters are again? I'm sorry.
Parameters are the effective dielectric constant of the protein.
And what, so what number did you choose?
I think in this paper we used about 60, but I don't remember, 30, I don't remember.
For the protein?
Yeah, 60. It's an effective parameter. It is not, that's what we used.
But water is 80 and lipid is 2, so.
Well, proteins are, most people doing Poisson-Boltzmann use about 20 for a protein.
Okay, okay. And then what was the other parameter?
The diameter of the pore.
The diameter of the pore. And so you tune those, so what you
do? No, I'll show you how we do it. But yeah, okay. Okay, I'll show you that okay, to some extent. Okay?
Why does charged holes stay in the channel?
Because they, in reality, are tethered on springs. Oh, it would be because we reject any move of the. We do it differently in each of the 70 papers. In the Monte Carlo, we just reject the move.
Okay, so it means that there is the total charge is not zero. It's not
neutral. Oh, no.
So there would be a huge electrostatic attraction to pull them
up. For which there's all sorts of direct experimental evidence in channels.
So, and roughly what's happening is. These ions have to come in to screen your negative charge.
Yes, exactly.
Calcium is the screener.
Yeah. And that's right. All we're doing is a modern theory of screening.
And it's driven by entropy. So
yes, exactly. We have to say it carefully. It's driven by entropy. That means that a measurement at 100 degrees Kelvin cannot get it right. Because the entropy is different by 10 or 20 kT.
But having said that, aren't we going to get basically these sort of curves quite generically and not worry about
I will show you.
Pauling ionic
gradients? I will show you.
To 1% accuracy?
I will show you.
Those are the curves you would get from setting up, I mean, not exactly, but generically, if you set up a Donnan equal.
Yeah,
three,
yeah.
That's
right,
what you
yeah.
will get.
And I completely agree with the idea that this is sort of, in a sense, a trivial application of screening. However, last year there were maybe 75 papers published on... Wait, no, let me finish. Well, you should, because that science goes by the total mass of knowledge, and unfortunately I've lived long enough to see ideas diluted out that get completely lost because there's so much nonsense. So linear Poisson-Boltzmann is extremely popular way to calculate, and it calculates screening wrong, and it's been known to calculate screening wrong by many KT since at least 1920s.
But could it be that, so this mechanism that you have, which is very interesting with the big balls moving around, I mean, if it's very easy to generate curves that have that shape, then it could be that the fitting parameters that you use to basically fit the selectivity thing to the thing that's actually being changed to something else.
Of course.
So it's possible that mechanistically.
But that's why I'm giving the rest of the talk to show that isn't the case.
Oh, okay. So.
Okay.
Good. You're going to show that the mechanism for selectivity.
I'm going to show what I'm going to show, and why don't you make the conclusions at the end? We have worried about what you said a great deal, and if I have time to go to Dirk's stuff, I will show you absolutely decisive evidence that the parameters are done correctly. Here you can decide for yourself. Wolfgang and I, when we did calcium channel, because exactly of those questions, by the way, we get sodium, lithium, potassium right, we get magnesium wrong in the theory we've done, but if you include water just as uncharged spheres, because it's the only thing we could do very badly, then you get magnesium amazingly close, within say 5 or 10%. Okay? Because of problems just like you talked about, even though we had something like 35 papers on the calcium channel, Wolfgang Nonner and I did not believe that these parameters meant more than a good effective description. Especially because, we published, I should just say that having a good effective description was of some interest to experimentalists, and because it hadn't been available before. And the reason that we were so skeptical was because of a challenge by Walter Stumme and Stefan Heinemann, both of whom I think gave their first seminars at Rush, by the way. Walter certainly did. Years ago, who did this mutation, and I don't remember which way they did it. They did a calcium into sodium. Anyway, it's been done both ways, that you can go to from a calcium channel into a sodium channel. And we could easily reproduce that change, but the crucial property of a sodium channel is its selectivity against potassium. And in our 35 papers, or 30 papers, we could not do that. So therefore, Wolfgang and I did not fully believe the model, thought it was some sort of effective model. Okay, so here is to show how you can make a sodium channel. What you do is you do a mutation of the crucial residues to a net charge of negative one, but crucially with a positive charge in there. So this environment is very salty, even though it's and very crowded, even though its net charge is only minus one. And the question is, what happens when we do the model? Well, here's what happens. If we include the dielectric energy, the mutation produces a sodium channel with no change of any parameters. Now, it can't be a simpler statement. We don't change anything. We would have.
By making the E to K.
That's the crucial one. Yes. No. E to K and E to A.
So you removed two carboxylates,
right,
and you replaced them with one positive charge
energy. Exactly. And that's all we did.
Okay.
Period.
So then you're keeping calcium down, sodium up.
And these are just straight simulation results. The reason I'm showing Monte Carlo is there's no discussion about what happened. Okay? And to the people who did this, it was mind-boggling. Because for 30 papers versions of this model, this was not, we didn't have the K-sodium. I haven't shown you the K-sodium. What's crucial, I'll show you in a second, is that there's also K-sodium selective.
Are there other interesting relations you can make?
Yes.
Well, it seems that there is a sort of very, very interesting and non-trivial statement that we made, that actual structure in the pore is not important, only charge matters.
No.
And hang on just one second. If I understand correctly, what you said is you did not need to put these red spheres in the right positions in
That's correct.
The place. So as long as they're in there and they bounce about and there's only so much entropy they can get from bouncing about, and there's only so much entropy to be had because of the exclusion volumes for these different calciums and potassiums, and we know that screening depends on entropy. So all good thermodynamics, but it has some immediate implications, some of which are also very interesting from the point of evolution, because you're emphasizing how you can engineer, turn a sodium channel into a calcium channel. And so there's a difference between finding one way of doing it or finding many ways of doing it. One of the very interesting evolutionary questions is, so how easy is it mutationally to turn the sodium channel, or for that matter, into select channel? So right now you're changing charge and things like this. But it seems to me that it's the most obvious test of this hypothesis that structure doesn't matter.
I didn't make that. That's what you're saying. It's not true. I'm going to show you it's not true. Why don't you say structure has to be computed?
Well, hang on a second. But at the moment, my question is the following. So suppose we would take a channel where all the residues are that are facing the innards, and you move one of your tetrad charges to another position in the box. So the prediction of this is that there is no change in selectivity. So can one do this sort of mutation experiment?
Well, that experiment has been done at length, and there isn't much. It's more complicated than that, and there are some properties that are uncovered in the Fossard stuff that we don't get.
You mentioned that your calculation gave very different results if you tethered the oxygen.
If you freeze them. If you freeze them. If you tether them.
If you do not. Mm-hmm. And that's because of an entropy. If you just freeze those carboxylates somewhere near the wall, you get a different.
Wildly different. So it's not just structure. Yes. Yes. And it doesn't matter where you freeze them. You have a profound effect.
So that's very different than a Donnan system.
Yeah, well.
Because a Donnan system does.
A Donnan of an ideal solution, but not of a real Donnan. Not, wait. the dominant columns that you biochemists have is not ideal. They have many, you build them so they're non-ideal. This is why I started with the second slide. Almost everything that's interesting is the non-ideal case, and that's exactly where the entropy is. Now, the reason I want to, I went through the same path that you went through about structure, okay? And have at times, excuse me, I think it's accurate, irritated Chris by saying structure was not important. I was dead wrong. Now, let me explain why. You can do a sensitivity calculation by any model that has ever been proposed of a channel. Because we have single charges that are only a few angstroms apart, the energy of moving those things a few hundredths of an angstrom is enough to change the selectivity dramatically by any calculation that is any model that's done. So that says structure is fantastically important. And those are very general arguments having to do with the electric field. And by the way, for physicists, this shows that scaling arguments about size are completely inappropriate in biology because everything stops when you get to the finite diameter of a sodium ion. Okay? The discreteness of the charge is the key. Now, what we do show is that you have to compute the location at their free energy minimum. What's special about these calculations is that the carboxylates are at their free energy minimum in the model, and that changes every time we change solutions. Okay? So the structure is so sensitive it has to be computed. And
Sorry, so you're saying that even though you're not fixing these grand balls, they sort of are in a very specific state.
No, I have to be very specific here and very, very aggressive. The Monte Carlo simulation puts everything in their free energy minimum robustly. So every member of this system is robustly at its free energy minimum, or the Monte Carlo doesn't converge. This is why we did Monte Carlo.
You're saying that there's a structure that's effectively jammed.
Not quite jammed, but effectively.
So there's a structure.
Yes.
So how do the ions move? Because ultimately they also have to flow.
Oh, well, there isn't any obvious answer to that except to solve the flow equations, and the flow equations show flow.
Well, so I guess what that means is flow, but
if you... No, they show current... No, wait, I don't want to...
A bunch of structures, right, manifold of structures...
Sure, it's called a Boltzmann distribution. Okay, so let's... Now, look, you can look your head at me, but we have spent many, many years answering these questions, so I don't want it dismissed. So what in the equilibrium thing, we have a Boltzmann distribution, which has been studied at length. In non-equilibrium, which no one else has ever published, okay, Dirk has the full distribution of location of every particle for every voltage and every current in 120 solutions in the ryanidine receptor and 6 mutations. This has all been done and published. You ask us where anything is and its variance and its distribution, and we have the code to do it.
That's why I asked you why you maintain the thing in the channel, because certainly they want to go out, so how can it be in equilibrium?
We are guessing that is good enough to predict the data. We obviously should have more realistic descriptions of each of the side chains and simply have not done it yet. That's the right answer.
About the simulation, the simulation seems to me cannot be in equilibrium since the ball wants to go out of the channel.
The box potential.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there is
Mm-hmm. No, that's a fair criticism. That's absolutely no
structure. This thing is effectively a low temperature, right? But it more or less goes into You can call it free energy, but it's effective free energy, right?
Yeah, of course. But your comment is absolutely fair. We have not. I want to say it very carefully. This is one of the things we have not done, and we have worried about, and we are working on with Chun Liu right now. Our boundary conditions, in effect, introduce energy into the system. And we, by the way, these are done universally in Monte Carlo things in chemistry. So I don't, we're not any worse than anyone else. We have not done an energetic analysis of the boundary conditions, and you're absolutely correct. However, this stuff is specific. This is a perfectly clear guess, and we get the same answers quantitatively with these 6 methods. For example, the DFT and the Monte Carlo, which have nothing to do with each other, the points actually are within 4 or 5%.
Your goals, the order, and so
None of us have looked at what happens during flow. It's in the calculations, it's in the computer. We just haven't analyzed that data. I don't know how much reordering there is as a function of current volume. It's a very good question, but I want to be sure everybody understands. This is characteristic of a fairly complex hydrodynamic problem, that there are many variables and questions you can ask that are in the computer but you just haven't asked. So that's right there, but we simply haven't asked that.
So maybe many of us puzzled by this references to hydrodynamics, because at least I was sort of assuming the thinking that you're in the regime where everything is happily fluctuating a lot. But now we've learned that actually they're more or less frozen, so that presumably only now a small number of states that are important. That may be involved in distribution, or
I don't,
once it's out of equilibrium, we'll know.
I don't know what any of those words mean. I don't know how to define state in this kind of system where everything is coupled through the boundary conditions and so on. When I say hydrodynamics, I'm referring to an exact set of equations which have a historical relationship to hydrodynamic equations that we're using. They are not derived. The Envera is derived, and if I have time, I can show you that. So excuse me, I'm using that in a loose way. Now, the crucial question here for Wolfgang and me was, do we select between sodium and potassium? Any one of those 30 papers gave us selectivity between calcium and sodium when we did the mutation. And here is the result. And the result was totally unexpected. Young people, we had no idea what we were doing. Okay, we just computed with the extra dielectric energy and wanted to see what would happen.
Well, the
dielectric energy was treating the protein as a different dielectric constant from the water. Okay, it took us a long time to learn how to do that. If you guys can do that quickly, if there's a physicist who knows how to do that quickly, let's tell us, and you, there's a, it's very important. And the three region, there should be a separate dielectric constant here, here, and here. We've now solved that. Dejo is writing up the papers on that. It doesn't change any of the conclusion, changes the parameters. The three dielectric problem, as far as we know, there are no papers on. Okay? There may be, but we don't know them. Okay? It turns out it's a nasty problem. It's because the Coulomb integral is singular in two different ways, one at the boundary and one at infinity. So it's a nasty numerical problem. It's not impossible. It just hasn't been done. So here is the result. This is the number density of these structures through the channel. There are binding sites now, binding sites defined as regions in which there are high concentrations compared to bulk. Concentration for us is number density. There's no ambiguity, just the number, okay? And what is striking is that these binding sites, oh, I need to remind everybody, there's no extra chemical energy introduced into this model at all. So binding energies in this model are an output. We don't have any chemical energies anywhere. The problem with putting chemical energies in this model is that they act as sources if you hold them constant when you change conditions. The only way you can maintain an energy or a force is by introducing charge or something else that perturbs the system. So the problem with the classical results where there were rate constants that were held constant or free energies that are put in and held constant is the only way that's physically realizable is by injecting charge if we have electrical forces. So we have none of those. It doesn't that if you knew how to do that, you could do them, but you don't. So what's striking here is the binding sites move with are different for sodium and potassium. And in general, every change that we make changes the structure and changes it significantly and changes the entropy. We actually haven't evaluated the entropy separately, but we think changes the entropy too. But it certainly changes everything. And every structure at which we've ever frozen things, Chris, because a tremendous argument among the co-authors is the how you define the average structure. Okay, and some of you may know how to do that better than we do. So we just did all of them. So wherever you freeze the ions, you make the carboxylates, you make a big effect. But we have binding sites. They are outputs, but they are not selective. The selectivity comes because potassium is not found at all in the middle. Now, if you ask me the very important question, why, the answer is we don't know. And the reason is that the word why implies breaking this into components of energy and free energy, entropy, There are many different components, and those calculations are just too hard to do in Monte Carlo. They can be done in DFT, PNP, and Dirk has a paper on that in other places.
The simplest answer is, I mean, I don't know anything, but it's just it doesn't fit.
It does fit.
There's more crowding.
But it's not true for
The only difference between sodium and potassium in your input
is diameter.
Is the diameter. That's it. Nothing to do with water interactions.
But cesium and rubidium get in there. But cesium and rubidium can get in.
In your model or in?
In the model.
In the model.
Wait a minute. Are you saying cesium
and rubidium can get in a little bit? I have to. I don't have a graph of their exclusion rule.
Cesium does not go to zero in the.
I believe it doesn't, but I need to get the graphs for you.
Have your model though, that
it needs to be, Chris. I need to give you the graphs, Chris. I want to just say it because I don't want to get it wrong. We did the calculation. It was shown to me about 3 years ago. That's how I remember it. We haven't published it, and I should re-examine it.
I mean, if you're not able to ask the why because of the, difficulty in dissecting all the energetic terms, you still can do experiments with it by putting different, look at how...
Well, except we can't...
Make up non-existent ions.
Yeah, the problem is, but we can't record from the L-type calcium channel stably.
I mean, she's talking about the model.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We simply haven't done it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It should be done. And by the way, if anybody is interested in doing this, we are glad to give you the code, okay, and help you reasonably to get it going, because we think all of these questions should be put up. And just so everybody understands, we do not think the model will survive all these things. We think obviously tethering involves some energy. We think obviously water will have some effects. We just don't know where. So we really are eager for people to help explore those. And this biologist likes to have sort of fancy pictures. So I want to show that we have binding sites, but the binding sites are not the source of selectivity. Now, it was sort of particularly embarrassing when I did this slide that we were writing the paper, and then one of my students came up and said, gee, you're really smart, Bob. You predicted all this. I said, what are you talking about? Well, it turned out 20 years ago I wrote a paper saying that depletion zones were going to be very, very important in channel function because they are how transistors work. I had forgotten it totally, so whatever that means. The depletion zone was, in fact, found empirically. And then one of my students remembered that somewhere or other it had been suggested. And we get lithium, potassium, cesium, and sodium about what the experiments are. So there's another property that comes out of this, Michael, which was even more surprising to the authors. I've had done a very bad job of explaining this to people, so I'm going to try again. In a complicated system like this, where we have effective variables that you were talking about, we don't know what the variables really mean. When you change one variable, almost every predicted function or phenotype changes. Things are not orthogonal. Okay? So if you take the sodium-calcium properties of any of these channels, and you change the diameter or you change the dielectric constant, everything changes. Imagine our surprise when we found that that was not true for sodium-potassium selectivity for the sodium channel. Now, this is the only case for which things are orthogonal, if I could use the math language. Here is showing selectivity as a function of diameter. This is the sensitivity kind of issue a number of you asked about. And you'll see, of course, that selectivity depends a great deal on diameter. So this model is extremely sensitive to structure, but only one parameter carries the structure. This is very much an engineering approach, right? And Dejo came in and showed me what happened when the dielectric constant was changed. And Dejo, being a good friend of 20 years standing, when he showed me that there was no effect at all of changing a dielectric constant by a factor of 8, guess what I said? Well, I'm a chairman, I got gray hair, I'm pompous ass, so what do I say to him? Dejo, for Christ's sake, for heaven's sake, you just showed me the same file twice. Why did I say that? When you change the dielectric constant by a factor of 8, which we did here, every force in the calculation changes enormously, and there are billions and billions of calculations. So to have two things come out the same after billions and billions of calculations, in which every force has changed by a factor of 8, the obvious response of a chairman is, can't be right. Dezsel muttered at me in Hungarian. He has never told me what he actually said in Hungarian. And being a very, very fine scientist, walked out of the room and redid the entire calculation. In fact, he actually did a little model calculation with new code because he was so concerned. And this is the correct result.
So it's just crowding that matters.
It's just crowding that matters for sodium versus potassium selectivity, but not for any other measure.
But that sort of makes sense because they have the same charge. So therefore, if they're going to select between them, the only difference is their size, so then it can only be crowded.
Yeah, but you could...
Sensitive to
oh yeah.
Size.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Why shouldn't the dielectric affect that?
But right. Changing the dielectric constant, the protein, the ceramic.
Oh well, it's the ceramic.
It's the protein.
That's
okay. We believe the same thing is true when we change the dielectric constant of the pore in the middle. But I don't have that graph. That's in the paper we're working on. It has to be done. Okay. I mean, Dejo undoubtedly. Yeah, but the Born energy is only...
Yeah, but
this... You guys are physicists. This is in crowded geometry with dielectric boundaries a few angstroms away. The Born energy is only a small piece of all the energies. The boundary condition energies are very, very large. There's a charge one angstrom from a dielectric jump. So the induced charge and polarization is very large. So it has to be calculated. But your kind of loose argument is very dangerous because you might say, look, sodium and calcium have the same diameter. So the only effect is their charge, and that's not true. They're not orthogonal variables. Okay? So if you look at sodium-calcium, I don't have the graph here. Sodium versus calcium have the same diameter, but they don't have any clean effect on ratio. And the other issue, which is just as amazing, is that occupancy, which we take as a rough measure of conductance, depends on the dielectric of the protein, the dielectric coefficient of the protein, but not on the diameter. So we actually have orthogonal control variables. And we think that's sort of interesting from an evolutionary point of view because it's obvious that the genome can control the diameter of the protein. We don't know how, because the structure problem is unsolved, but it obviously can do it. And it obviously can control its dielectric coefficient by throwing in some residues that are polar or nonpolar.
Units of occupancy?
These are our occupancies are very low. I think
very low
occupancies. Yeah, very low occupancies.
I mean, well, wait a minute. I mean, so you've got a very high charge, you've got a very high negative charge density in there, and you've got a very low occupancy of the cation. So
there's a lot of electric field. There's a huge electric field that's balanced.
You've got an enormous electric field.
That is balanced.
No.
And that is balanced by the double layer.
So that's coming.
I'm sorry. Well, don't call them image charge. Polarization. But I mean, here they are. These are outside. These binding sites are outside. You can't see it very well. There's the selectivity filter. These are the ionic.
What you're calling the selectivity filter is the box
yes.
in which the fixed
yes.
charges are fixed.
Mm-hmm.
So
we've computed.
They are sitting at the edges.
Yes.
They have a hard time, and so
those occupancies.
Those occupancies
were for the selectivity.
Okay.
And we've done it both ways, and the numbers are available. And we argued about what was the least misleading, Chris.
All right. So they're just sticking their toes in every once in a while.
Right. And any of you who are familiar with transistors know that transistors are engineered to have these kind of boundary layers. That's how transistors work. They are built to have these boundary layers so control is possible.
Sorry, I had a naive
I'm sorry.
Maybe you already said how. What's the ratio of the size of these red balls to these ions? I forgot.
Oh, it's order one. They're about the same diameter. Well, they aren't. Here are the exact numbers.
So they're not very
they're not
close.
Very different. nobody in their right mind, excuse me, that I know, would build a system this way a priori. I mean, we found this out backwards, okay? We had no idea that it was going to come out this way, okay? But that's how it comes out. And so in summary, electrostatic interaction, we get the, now, what's very important here is that, believe it or not, what we've computed is something that has been discussed for 50 years and then died. This is what I mean by ideas diluting out in the protein literature, at least as far as I know. The original physicists who came to biochemistry, or they wouldn't have called it that, to molecular biology in the 40s, were tremendously interested in proteins and amino acids, and nucleic acids being self-organized. They were excited actually for a historical fluke because they had thought of only ATP-driven things, but they used the word self-organized. I am unable to find a reference where they converted that into the mathematical statement which they had all been trained in of Boltzmann distribution. And there was a famous biochemist named Koshland, who worked up the road here, for many, many years, talked about the induced fit model of proteins, saying that active sites had a structure that changed with the substrate. I am unaware of a reference, but I am eager to be corrected, because he was a wonderful man, in which he talked about that having to be an induced entropy as well. So what we have done is to define self-organized as a Boltzmann distribution and actually compute it. And we define structure, and this is why I was so rude, and I didn't mean to be personally rude, but we've computed structure as an output. This is why I was so sensitive. And it's crucial that it's self-organized and induced. Now, our model is clearly wrong. We left out that boundary energy. It's clear that there's some energy stored in the protein. Why do we think we don't see this? And some entropy effects. Well, we think it's simply because the crowding produces these enormous energies. The electrostatic energies, Chris, as you pointed out, are many KT, and the crowding is even worse. The crowding is very, very high energies. So we think biology has chosen two energies to dominate the problem. Hell, that's what Stephen Jay Gould talks about in 700 books about evolution choosing specific pieces of physics or whatever to do its task. So we think we have stumbled on, young people, without knowing what we were doing, we think we have stumbled on the adaptation here. Now that's a working hypothesis to be tested, and one of the important tests, Chris, and you already said we should do the rubidium curves and we should do it with three dielectrics, okay? And I'm gonna write that down afterwards, and there will be many more such tests. So I do not want anyone to think we feel we have it all, but we think we have two crucial energies, okay? And then there is another point, which is a little bit more controversial, but needs to be said. If an engineer has a model that deals with all of his data, and somebody comes along with a fancier model, that fancier model has to give the same results for the same system as the first model before it's useful. Here we have a model that gets this right over a tremendous range of conditions. We believe that molecular dynamics will do this stuff much better, including water, for example. But before we can tell whether it's doing better, it had better get spheres right. And those codes can do spheres. And they haven't been published because they don't get them right. Okay? I know this because we have a paper on this right now. Okay? So one of the lessons here is that to go along, you have to test the hypothesis that these energies are important. You've got to be able to compute them reliably. That's all. Okay. Now, I just also want to say that, and I thought Chris was going to get me on this, it's very well known, because it's the word osmotic pressure, okay, that there have to be large mechanical forces involved. And we propose as a working hypothesis that the mechanical forces that are generated by these mechanisms are what drive conformation changes. Those of you who are physical scientists often come to biology and lose your physical intuition. And you happily accept arrows. Well, when you say A going to B in a conformation change with an arrow, you say nothing. Because you have to specify the energetics and the source of the energy, where it comes from boundary conditions. I have been worried since I was a little boy, 17, about what drove conformation changes. And one possibility are these class of mechanical forces, which are inseparable. You can't have these models without them. And finally, I just want to just show you the kind of fits that Dirk has got. This is comparing DFT and Monte Carlo. There are no adjustable parameters. No adjustable parameters in those comparisons. And these are the current voltage curves that have been selected for the worst fits out of 120 different solutions. By the way, these kind of linear current voltage curves are harder to predict than the curvilinear ones because the functions are so curvilinear. And very importantly, if a huge mutation is made, this was the one that convinced Gerhard Meissner, who took this data, you can take all the permanent charge out of Dirk's protein, out of the ryanidine receptor. So this is a huge intervention from 13 molar to zero, and you get quantitative fits. Okay, which are just amazing. And we think, I think, Dirk is not as aggressive as I am. He's a much nicer person. I think that this shows that he has to have the electrostatic energy right. I don't think you can possibly go from 13 molar to zero. It also shows that this is a very peculiar protein because it can't change diameter at all, okay, even though there's these enormous changes in forces, if the theory is right. You take out all of the fixed charge in the narrow region. I actually don't know how he did it. I'm sorry.
I mean the actual.
The actual.
Single mutation. So
yes.
Going,
those are the mutations.
Yeah, okay, so that's a removal of a single negative charge.
Right.
Four negative charges.
Mm-hmm.
So in the model, four red balls go out.
Mm-hmm.
And there are no other adjustable parameters.
There's one parameter that Dirk has to pick up from one of the curves under one condition, and he never changes. Okay? And I'm not presenting Dirk's stuff here in detail, so that he uses eight parameters instead of R2. I mean, there's complexity, but the data is beyond belief. It's 120 solutions, and then for our traditional channel people, the AMFE was predicted before it was measured, and Gerhard lost the stake. And so before he would, anyone knows Gerhard Meissner knows he's a wonderful old friend, but he's not generous with buying stakes for people. And my only role in this was to suggest the experiment, nothing else. And so he did 62 measurements, okay, to show that there is an anomalous mole fraction, and this was predicted before the experiments were done, and has nothing to do with the occupancy kind of arguments that are traditionally done. It just has nothing to do with it. And all of this was predicted before, all those theory curves were predicted before the experiments. This is how the AMFE varies. There's a lot more data. And even three ions, mixtures of three ions have been predicted. And I'm very proud, Dirk is a former student of mine, so I'm very, very, I'm in a way more proud of him than I would ever be of anything I did myself. There are almost no three-ion mixture fits in the bulk solution literature. Okay, so
this is for a protein that has no structure known.
Right.
In a family for which there's no structure known.
Okay, yeah, the latter part I didn't know, but you'll excuse me. And I, in a way, I shouldn't be presenting his results, but these are all published and very relevant to the point.
Well, the structure, but it's a six-action.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
okay. And now, the question then comes, how do you deal correctly with spheres? And I'm just going to show one. That's it. One more slide. This is it. And the question was raised very correctly, mathematically, what do we do with boundary energies? People could very correctly ask, how the devil do we do DFT, PNP? There are all sorts of problems with it. What I want to say is that the standard method for dealing with this kind of problem, in my understanding, in much of physics, are variational methods. These have the tremendous advantage of not specifying partial differential equations, but specifying energies, and the partial differential equations are outputs of the specification. That kind of treatment has not been possible for chemical systems. Many people have tried because no one really knew how to handle the dissipation. And Chun Liu, who is a distinguished applied mathematician has worked out this variational principle for the problem of oil droplets in a Navier-Stokes fluid. And these, there are 10 or 15 papers on this from him and many others, and then the systems have been built. And he identified the mistake that Onsager made, which was to compute dissipation with respect to X. It's got to be computed with respect to V, and the variation combined this way. So we are in the process, and Onsager made that mistake, Chris, because at that time there was no variational theory for multiple variables. And he actually identifies in his paper he didn't know what to do. No. But Chun deserves tremendous, in my opinion, tremendous credit. So we are now in the process of taking this treatment, which automatically answers all of your questions, okay, because it computes all the energies automatically, and taking this theory of spheres and dealing with it in a variational way. Thank you very much.